I'll just offer a few reflections tonight at the beginning of our Vasa retreat, which is really, in one sense, it's nothing special. It's just another moment, another night. Not necessarily standing out anything special in one sense. But in another sense, it's actually a very, very wonderful and rare opportunity that we've here actually worked quite hard to move towards creating a space wherein those of us who are spending the Rains Retreat here, monastic and lay, can really have this opportunity for a quiet time. I've often reflected in recent years that, you know, what is the most precious thing in this world? And I'm sure different people could come up with different answers or different ideas for what that means to them. But in the last few years in particular, for me, the most precious thing is time and space to just be. Because this world of ours that we live in, it's very hard to find time and space and quietude and a situation that's supported to be so. And maybe there's probably many people who do live alone and maybe aren't as active as they would like, and actually perhaps they have a lot of time and space to themselves, but they may not want it because it's not what they're looking for. They're looking for something else. So I guess my sense of what's precious has come out of a relatively busy few years, but also in what I see in the world around me, the way people are racing with the clock and against the clock, with more and more things to do and get done. And what are we racing towards? It's a good question to ask. What is the world, or people at large, what are they racing towards? It would be an interesting survey to do, I think. And I remember when Ajahn Brahm visited briefly last year, I remember overhearing when he was talking with a bunch of lay people downstairs after the meal, just giving a bit of a Dharma reflection. And I was kind of just standing to the side, and he was saying, "Where's everyone going to?" And the group were mute. So, "Where are you all going?" He said, "I'll tell you where you're all going. You're all going to the cemetery. That's where you're going." Fortunately, most people laughed and got the humour of it, because it's so true. It's exactly, you know, where are we going? You know, on our daily lives, we've got so many things to do and places to go, and so much kind of momentum that we keep moving towards these kind of relative short-term goals. And much of it is just about making a living, making ends meet, putting food on the table, bringing up your family, etc., etc. But the whole world gets caught up in a lot more, the chasing of leisure time, chasing of holidays. With some of my people I know who love to go on holidays. They don't like their work so much, but they love to go on holidays, which is a fair enough thing. But then it's a cycle, isn't it? You've got to go to work to pay for your holidays, and then you can enjoy your holidays, but then you've got to go back to work. And I thought it was a very relative thing. We worked a holiday and we holiday, or rather our holidays make meaning of our work and our work makes meaning of our holidays. And I think if we had enough time and enough encouragement to just stop for a while and really ask the question, where am I going? Where am I truly going? Recognizing the finiteness of life and really asking the question, what do I want to do with it? How do I want to live? I don't know how much time I've got in this particular incarnation to really come to grips with that. And for many people who have family commitments, there's not much choice. I really understand that. But it doesn't mean we don't ask the question, because it can totally reorder our priorities. And it can totally change how we do what we do. It may change what we do, or it may not. But the question, if truly taken deeply, can change how we do what we do. Because to chase the proverbial happiness in the future is just a never-ending race. So happiness, true happiness, must really be found now. So for me, the idea of having time and space to really explore these questions and explore the teaching of the Buddha, which very much encapsulated this experience of a human life in his teaching on the Four Noble Truths, looking at the experience of suffering, the search for happiness. Then we either find more suffering, or we find worldly happiness, or we find transcendent happiness. So we really talked about, in some ways, all of these options, but the Four Noble Truths points us in the direction of transcendent happiness. The peace and happiness that's found with coming to really understand this cycle of dukkha, this cycle of samsara, how dukkha, how our suffering manifests in our own minds, and how we can come to a place of truly understanding that, and in understanding it, letting go of the causes of suffering, whereupon we find that deep peace of Nibbana. So Nibbana is not in the future, Nibbana is not out there, it's not a heaven above. Nibbana is that which lies within each of us, just as suffering lies within each of us, the cause of suffering lies within each of us. Nibbana, the actuality, the experience of Nibbana can only be experienced within each one of us when the causes of suffering are let go of. That's when Nibbana arises or is seen, is penetrated within one's own heart, within one's own mind. It's nowhere else. So this is really helpful to get a handle on, because our conditioned mind that seeks happiness, it's a pattern that always futurizes the happiness. It depends on getting something else or going somewhere else, or it depends on something changing. But the peace of Nibbana is completely unconditioned, not dependent. So if we'd really contemplate this possibility, just as the Dharma is described as apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inwards to be experienced individually by the wise, each for themselves. So important to recollect this as much as possible. This lays, this experience, this knowledge, this reality lays within. Closer than our own breath. So when we remember this, recognize this, it can help stop that momentum, which that patterned habitual momentum which keeps pushing us forward into the next moment, into the next moment, or keeps our mind thinking about the future or regretting the past, or it can help wake us up to just this moment where there is full conscious awareness. And what is this experience, full conscious awareness? The Buddha encourages us to explore that and to gradually peel the layers of our assumptions, our presumptions, our views. Allow them to gradually fall away, just through our willingness to be present with what is, and just experience this simple process of living, this simple act of breathing, being, all the mundaneness of this body-mind, the things we have to do to look after the body, eating, sleeping, walking, cooking, cleaning. These things can seem very mundane, and in fact they are very mundane, and yet the encouragement in the Buddha's teaching on the Satipatthana Sutta, the foundations of mindfulness, saying that this is the direct path to the realization of Nibbana, is the cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness. And that's just what he's saying, to really give all your mindfulness to being with this process of body and mind. And you're walking, you're talking, you're washing, you're eating, you're sleeping, you're waking. Notice what happens in the mind as we encounter pleasurable or painful experiences, as we remember the past or conceive of the future. If we notice that, be willing to really look into that, not to assume a me in mind, but look into the phenomena. When we have the space and time to explore this experience of being in a meditative, contemplative frame, then our experience of being can change dramatically. And this is the preciousness of the opportunity we have. In a way, it's when we get given, or when we have this time just to be, that actually allows almost an entry into the timeless. through this practice of mindfulness, through this willingness just to be with the way things are from moment to moment, and explore what it is just to let go of anything we might find we're hanging on to. There's no one kind of dictating how we have to practice. It's really a territory that we just move into gradually, as much as we're able and willing to just explore to the degree that we can do that and feel relatively comfortable with it. And certainly, the Buddha's middle way, he really was quite clear that this truth to be found isn't to be found through extreme practices, isn't to be found through practices which harm oneself, which harm the body, or through strict austerities, but nor is it to be found in just hedonistic indulgence in sense pleasures, because we get completely lost in that and actually create more addictive habits in a way. But his middle way was really, coming into the middle. It's not mediocre by any chance, but really it's more coming into our own middle way, if you like. For each of us, it's going to be different at different times of our lives, at different points in our lives, and we have to work out for ourselves, feel out for ourselves what's working for us, what's good for this body, this heart, at this moment. So whilst we can perhaps challenge ourselves with some practices, I would advise to really keep a heart of loving kindness towards oneself with however you practice, whatever kinds of practices you engage. Bring that quality of metta, of loving kindness towards oneself and others, bring it to the fore and go gently in your practice. It doesn't mean we don't challenge sleepiness if that comes along. We don't challenge doubt, or we don't challenge anger or desire when it comes along. I think what I'm trying to say more is to, particularly for us Westerners, is go easy if you see yourself giving yourself a hard time. Because the inner critic, I think Mara can slip most easily into the guise of the inner critic. Mara being the kind of personification of delusion, or the thing that doesn't want us to escape the sense world, doesn't want us to realize nibbana. Mara is in his kind of guise in the Buddhist allegories, he's king of the sense world, and he only starts paying attention to people who are getting close to some realization. And for Westerners, it's very important to recognize the inner critic, to recognize how self-deprecation and guilt tripping is a big part of our mental culture, our mental conditioning. And we're going to have to come to terms with it in a contemplative practice. So we need to bring in loving kindness and recognize that inner critic for what it is. It's just a nagging voice. It's probably been around for a long time. You would have inherited it from your parents, and they from theirs, and they from theirs. And our cultural milieu is full of the the critic, the highly discriminative mind, which kind of slashes up everything that doesn't measure up to what we want, and blames, a lot of blaming. In our cultural conditioning, a lot of external blaming. So all of this stuff gets internalized. And for spiritual practitioners, I've certainly been through lots of it, and I know and see others going through it. We can give ourselves a really hard time if we're not being absolutely perfect or measuring up to our own expectations of what my practice should be. So I really encourage you to recognize that inner critic and just say, I know you, Mara. That was the Buddha's victory when he recognizes Mara. I know you, Mara. He doesn't have to destroy Mara. Recognize that he just says, I know you. I know you for what you are, and it kind of cuts the knees out of it. Ah, that's just the critic. There's the judge. Don't judge the judge. But just know it as a particular thread, a particular mind state that can get particularly charged. And very often when we're left to a lot of contemplative time, when we don't have so much social interaction or other engagements, we can get, you know, when we pay attention to a lot to our inner processes, the critic can get the upper hand sometimes. So just be aware and call it for what it is. And explore, experiment with releasing it, letting it go. Putting it on the shelf, saying, I know you, but you can just take a step back. You know, or if you're going to sit there and nag, if it won't go altogether, then just say, yep, that's the sounds of the crows in the trees. Just let it be in the background and don't give it too much attention. But really bring forth that loving kindness towards oneself and gentleness towards oneself. And just redirect your attention to what feels wholesome in this body and mind's experience. And that could be something as simple as a neutral feeling in the body, or a slightly pleasant feeling of ease or tranquility when you're doing some walking meditation or sitting meditation. I talked about some of the enlightenment factors last night. So if within our practice, if we come across what we might call a difficult mind state or a dark mind state, use your investigation and think, well, what can I bring forth here that will balance this out? Just recognize what's present and what quality. Review those seven factors of enlightenment. Is it mindfulness? Is it investigation of Dhamma? Is it energy? Is it joy? Is it tranquility, one-pointedness, or equanimity? Is it any one of these things that I might be able to bring forth to just bring some balance, not to destroy, not to have this attitude of needing to get rid of something, but more an attitude of bringing balance. And when you find a way to bring balance, that which isn't so helpful or so wholesome can sometimes just fade out. But it's up to each of us just to explore what works. And since we took the eight precepts tonight, and it's the beginning of a period in the monastery, just an encouragement too to hold them gently, to hold them carefully. And if at any time there's a lack of mindfulness and one transgresses the precepts, to just be aware of that. The Buddha talks about just acknowledging if one has transgressed a precept. It's not something we want to go into guilt about. It's just to acknowledge and to redirect or re-establish your intention back towards the precepts. And if it's helpful to acknowledge it to someone else, you're most welcome to come to me. If it's helpful just to acknowledge it with yourself, that's really fine. And so it's just these training precepts are not laws. They're like things that can help wake us up when we say, I'm really going to try and hold to this precept. But if, you know, we're not perfect, they're just there to reflect to us certain behaviors and tendencies for us to begin to understand what they're about. So I used to think of it as a kind of, when we come close to the edge of maybe transgressing a precept, it's like a little a boundary, it rings a little bell sometimes, and that just gives me a chance to have a look. Oh, what's happening here? Is there anger in the heart? Is there desire in the heart? Is there doubt in the heart? What's happening here? So they're just like a boundary to help reflect back to us what's going on. For the monastics, we have a way of acknowledging transgressions, which is helpful. So again, the Buddha said this is wisdom when one acknowledges a transgression and is able to just re-establish one's intention towards not doing that in the future. But it's like a little kid learning how to ride a bike. Sometimes there's lots of falling off and it can hurt, but that's how we learn. That's what the learning's all about. And sometimes that's what I see the middle way as well. The middle path, as we discover it and learn it within our own practice. The way we learn it, we find ourselves veering off to the left and falling into the gutter on the left. And we pick ourselves up and we come back to the middle. And then we find ourselves veering off to the right and falling into the gutter on the right. We pick ourselves up and come back to the middle. This is one way of talking about it. And it's interesting because there's a story of Ajahn Chah that I think someone suggested that he was perhaps hypocritical or contradictory in his own teachings, because sometimes he would say something to one person, say something different to another person. And Ajahn Chah just said, well, if I see someone coming towards me and they're veering off to the right, I'll tell them to go left, go left. And then if I see someone coming towards me and they're veering off to the left, I'll tell them, go right, go right. So I think this is a really interesting teaching, because what he's saying, what he's pointing to, is there's no ultimate truth in words or directions or meditation instructions or particular teachings. There's no ultimate truth. They are relative to who and what is happening right now. This is very important because we tend to, as unenlightened beings, we tend to grasp at things. And sometimes we grasp at the teachings as ultimate truths or the precepts as ultimate truths. We grasp at these things and we measure ourselves by it and we measure others by it. And that is truly a cause of dukkha. That's not awakening. These teachings, as the Buddha clearly said, are skillful means pointing to something pointing to a reality that can be realized. And he gave so many different teachings to so many different beings. But for all of those beings who awakened in his presence, they may have awoken through very different kinds of teachings, and they might not have been aware of all of the other teachings he gave to others. But that one for them was what was helpful, to see something, to understand something, to let go of something. So as the realization of freedom within was clearly apparent. So these teachings, these words are all skillful means geared to help reveal something within yourself. So ultimately, the outer teacher can be a great benefit, but ultimately, the truth lay within you, within each of us. So ultimately, as the Buddha also said, be a guide unto yourself. Rely on oneself, be a refuge, be a light unto oneself. Because when you travel this path, you will have to guide yourself. It will be your own wisdom guiding you ultimately. So where the outer teaching can help awaken that inner wisdom, very good. But that outer teaching is just a skillful means not to be grasped at. To the point where the Buddha even said of his own teaching, he said, my teaching is a raft. And in kind of implied, you know, you build a raft for yourself. We're on one side of the stream of samsara. The other side of the stream is nibbana. You recognize you've got to cross the stream. So you build a raft out of whatever you've got on this side, out of sticks and stones and reeds and whatever you can find to build a raft, whatever is offered you, whatever is available. And you use that raft across the stream. And the Buddha called his own teaching a raft. He said, once you've crossed the stream, do you think it would be helpful to pick that raft up and carry it round on your shoulders for the rest of your life? And who he was speaking to said, no, Lord, that would be foolish. He said, just so. You leave that raft there and then you go your way. So you don't even grasp the Dhamma that helps you cross the stream. Doesn't mean you can't use it if you need it. It's not an ultimate truth in itself. It's a skillful means to realize the ultimate truth within. The unconditioned reality, which is ungraspable. In a way, this path of letting go, learning how to let go, it's like learning to develop this muscle that can just release. We've so much developed a muscle that can grab and hang on, grab, hang on to this, that, grab, hang on. But actually, the path, you can think about it as we're developing the skill of letting go. Whatever it is we see we're hanging on to internally, what is it to let go, to let go? And then when we discover we can do that, we come into the presence of the ultimate ungraspable, which is the unconditioned reality. And maybe it's not until we've developed that capacity to not grasp, to not cling, can we truly recognize this ungraspable reality. And truly taste it and be it. It's not anywhere else. It's within your own being, your own experience. So to just call on that popular bit of wisdom of Ajahn Chah to finish this talk. And I'm sure we've all heard it before, but it seems timely. If you let go a little, you get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you get a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you find complete peace. So this is our precious opportunity for the 3 months, those of us who are staying here, to keep reflecting on these words of the masters, to point us back to this moment, to recognize in any moment where there might be clinging, and to explore how that might be released skillfully, with kindness, with compassion. So I'll finish there for tonight. Thank you.